Poetry very accidentally. But then when I looked back after I'd started writing, I sort of realised that I had been doing something, writing sort of short things and musical things for a very long time. I just never really considered them to be poems. It was just sort of scribbling. But my first formal poetry writing happened while I was still at school. I'm showing my age now, but I was the first year to go through a new schooling system. Or a new exam system in New South Wales, which for the first time included an extra component of English under which students were able to work on a major work in the way that art students or drama students already could. And so for the very first time, I sort of sat down and started working towards an extended project. And I was originally going to write short stories until I realised that everything that I was writing was much shorter than a short story really should be. And then had a bit of a play around and realised that what I was doing was, in fact, poetry. So from there, I started reading, and I started reading a lot, and I started reading obsessively, as I've always been slightly prone to do, and it just never really stopped, which is lovely. When I studied media and communications at university, and as a part of that, we had to do an internship. And I kind of got all defiant and refused to go to a media organisation and went to a poetry company instead, the Red Room Company, that's still operating in Sydney and that works a lot in producing poetry for radio or for public installations and things like this. So I very quickly got to meet a lot of people who were writers and who were poets, very quickly got to do the sort of ideas talking and reading that's so important to what we do. And I ended up staying there for 5 years. Yeah, that was certainly really valuable work. And I think that most important thing of meeting other people who are doing the same thing has always been really important to me. And I've always tried to keep a firm community of writers around me. Inner West. The things you notice once you leave. That here, the postman comes on foot, the curled hairs on his bolstered calves glowing ginger in the sunlight, his tourist-sized backpack and boots. That here, the garbage trucks are crude and frantic through the fiendish one-way streets and terraced corners, and the bins are only buckets. That the front garden sprout bikes, or chubby succulents, but never grass. And you can hear your neighbours singing, closing doors and climbing stairs, can smell their evening curries and find their cats inside your window. That here there are no teenagers, but sports utility strollers, and even the retirees are tightly muscled. That you can rent a parking space for $50 per week. The hairdressers are organic, and the dentist's holistic, and the graffiti is commissioned by the council. Inner West is the first poem in the book, and I wrote this just after I got involved with the West Side Writers Group, which is a group of young writers based in Western Sydney, that sort of started up under the auspices of a youth development centre in Bankstown and a writing project run by the University of Western Sydney. And the idea behind the group was to write about Western Sydney, which is such a strange and unusual place, and quite a special place that really isn't represented much in Australian writing, except from as the outside, as a place of sort of fear and violence or, you know, mediocrity and conformity. It's a place with a very high migrant population, very ethnically and culturally diverse. And it's also slowly becoming the geographical heart of Sydney, even though it's really left behind. And this first poem that I wrote with the group, I wanted to find a way to write about the area in its absence. I grew up in the suburbs. I now live in the inner west of Sydney. And I remember the period when I first moved there, really realised how so much of the physical landscape and the cultural landscape too, I guess, in a way, of where I'd grown up, I'd always taken for granted, as I guess everybody does, that you don't realise it's special or beautiful or different until you're confronted with a different way of living that somebody else takes for granted as the way the world works. So it's a very new thing to me to be living in such close quarters to other people, with small backyards, with smaller streets and people who walk everywhere rather than, you know, drive up the road. Quite an adjustment. And I think that led to one of the big interests in a lot of the poems in this first section of the book that are very much about the social setting and the way that people live their lives next to and against each other, I suppose, even within the one city. We drove to Auburn. It certainly felt like a food safari, such a long way from Kirribilli. I'd googled Moroccan grocers. There wasn't anything, so I figured that Turkish would do. Auburn. We drove to Auburn. I didn't know it's so economically challenged. The shops had no window displays, no proper signs. The coffee tasted bitter. But we bought orange blossom water and pomegranate syrup, so much cheaper than over here, although we had to pay for petrol. It's a long way from Kirribilli. They served our pastries on a plastic plate. The waiter wouldn't tell me what they were. He just said, biscuit and sweet. And I'm intolerant of tree nuts anyway. We spent $60 on wholesale Turkish delight. I know it's not to theme, but we can have it with our sticky later on. I think my off-the-shoulder embarrassed them. It's a long way from Kirribilli. There was a torture rehabilitation clinic right next to the delicatessen. One of the first poetry books that I ever fell in love with, I found on my mother's bookshelf, and it was a 1970 copy of a Russian poet, Yevgeny Yevtushenko's Bratsk Station, which is a kind of long extended narrative sequence about an electricity station in Siberia, which sounds like the thrilling stuff of poetry. It's a really bolshy book. It's all about workers and their struggle and the snow and that sort of thing. But it was the first time I'd come across poetry that was really narrative driven, really about people and their lives and the way that they speak. And that fascinated me because it went against all of the false ideas I'd had about poetry beforehand, that it's something, you know, difficult and antiquated and not really a part of the world in which we live. That was very important to me. And then early on, similarly, I came across the work of Dorothy Porter, who's always been a very important poet to me because her work is so feisty and sexy and bold and was a real revelation to me. She also writes a lot of verse novels, so I really do think that this idea of narrative has always been important to me. I also love the work of Judith Wright, who I will admit I first read out of vanity, imagining that one day my book would be sort of right beside hers on the library shelf. I'm not ashamed to admit that. And Dorothy Hewitt, of course, who I also loved because she was a bit of a firebrand and a bit of a radical, as has always been one of my favourite poets. To the children of poets. To the children of poets, On behalf of all poets, I apologise. I apologise for your obscure literary names you'll spend a lifetime spelling out, or at the very least explaining and helping people to pronounce. I apologise for your vocabulary. Your classmates won't find it endearing or quaint. I apologise for the unwanted help you'll get on your English homework, and for the years of books as birthday presents when all you really want is an Xbox, and how you might not have a TV or a microwave or be allowed to eat McDonald's. I'm sorry for the evenings when you will have toast for dinner because your parents have been writing, and the weeks where you'll eat nothing but black plums because they read about them somewhere and they sounded so delicious. I apologise for the nights their friends will wake you with bad puns and arguments over a colon, and for the blue cheese left to fester on the table overnight. I apologise for boring launches, even if you manage to snatch free wine, and for the strange skin conditions you'll pick up in second-hand bookshops. I'm sorry for the ugly boots and textured jumpers that will greet you at the school gates, and for the endless cups of tea you'll be so good at making. To the children of poets, I apologise for the imaginations you'll inherit and hope you'll grow to be a dentist or a banker or a plumber and will be able to afford good nursing homes. To the Children of Poets is one of my favourite poems in the collection. I wrote it as a bit of a joke poem to begin with because a whole bunch of my poet friends suddenly got pregnant all at the same time. And I started thinking about what a wonderful thing it would be to have a poet as a parent, and in many of the cases to have two poets as parents, given that we do live very strange lives at times and are certainly interested in very unusual things. The first time I read this poem was to a group of friends just to get a little bit of feedback. And one of them asked me straight out if my parents were poets, and they're not. My parents are school teachers. And he said, oh, let me guess, are they English teachers? And I said, no, one's a maths teacher and one's a science teacher, which, you know, was the cause of much hilarity. I think I realised that when I first started writing and first started thinking about this might actually be something that I want to do, it was a type of lifestyle that no one in my family really had any idea about what it was. It's not like when you say you want to be a doctor or a nurse or a teacher or a dentist or a plumber or whatever, and there's a kind of set trajectory of what you do. Nobody I knew could visualise what it looked like to work as a writer or a poet and how you'd actually go about that. So I sort of learnt everything on the fly, and the more I learnt, the more I liked it. But the poem always gets a really good response when I read it out at readings. It seems to have a lovely sense that a lot of people think that it's written for them or about them. And I've also had a lot of friends take it up to read to their children, which I think is quite a lovely sign. Persimmon poem, after Marjorie Barnard. At first cut, it collapses like a slashed tyre. This translucent flesh, a fecundity that defies politeness, the tidy. My sharp lap and angled fingers intrude. Shaped like a young woman's breast, she said, this fat and pulpy spill. I am recovering. I too. My mind as transparent and tender as new skin. In these, the blazing autumn afternoons where light falls thick and desperate, my vegetable garden glowing gold and pulpy red. I always thought this a female fruit, revelled in the lush tautology. Seeds crack between my teeth. The pit is pronged and angular. I'm glad this portends a mild winter. I think of as being slightly emblematic for a lot of the book, and it's for that reason that there's an image of a persimmon on the cover of the book, which I'm so pleased with because it's just beautiful. The image is from a Western Australian botanical artist called Vicky Lee Johnston. I wrote this poem after a period of illness when I was just starting to recover, and at that time I read Marjorie Barnard's story, The Persimmon Tree, which is also a story about illness and recovery, but also about isolation and strange female friendships. There's a persimmon tree growing in an apartment opposite where a young woman is staying, and fruit on a windowsill to become this kind of symbol of connectedness between her and a stranger. And there's some lines in the poem that come directly from that story. So shaped like a young woman's breast is one of them, and my mind as transparent and tender as new skin. And when I read that line, I was really taken aback. It felt to me as such a perfect encapsulation of what illness can do to you, that when you start getting better, there's a real transparency and newness to the way you're sort of forced to live your life. The persimmon, I suppose, was important to me. I lost a lot of weight while I was sick, and there was something really lovely about finally being able to eat again and to be able to eat something so luxurious and so messy that it was a really magical experience in a way. When I was putting the book together and sort of looking back at it, I realized much later that there is a sort of sense of illness or frailness through many of the poems just sitting under the surface that I hadn't even been conscious of at the time. It's always so interesting to see what comes out rereading your work when time has passed. I think that was particularly interesting for me because this is my first collection and I'd never had to look back at poems before. And in many ways, I felt it was a little bit like reading old diaries sometimes and learning a lot about the way I was thinking at particular times that had kind of escaped me in the moment. Harbour. They were mid-ocean when Singapore fell. How narrowly they avoided narrowing under the press of railway sleepers and wormy rice in someone else's jungle. A surplus army. The vibration of the ship's engine, the vibrato of the birds. The air hangs heavy with diesel fume and rainstorm, a shifting delirium of calls. Trincomalee, the word dances the industry of dockers, the curled syllables tight as bird bones. My grandfather's tongue limbered, loosened long before his body. I have only these stories of his war. Eka, deka, tuna, he learnt. One, two, three. And Lassana Kella, pretty girl. Night. The rough weft of a mosquito net blown against the face. The press of crevices and bones. The crevices of language, I step outside and slip between, snagged on their sharp edges. The stars span the coastline, the pontilist fireflies, the dark matter breathing between them, the salty hairs sweat upon my skin. A chili seed burns and lingers, grains of sand in my shoes. On a tin can bus, my thighs rattle. Skin and vinyl in minute conversation. The cradled oil lamps of a temple burr in the dusty window. Black ash curled on the hot air warp and on my tongue. Raw I am. Unripe. This poem, Night, is sort of a companion piece to Harbour. They're the opening poems of a longer sequence in the centre of the book called Inheriting Colombo. I wrote these poems after I worked in Sri Lanka for a period of time, which I think I did partly out of youthful stupidity. I wanted to go to a place that I didn't know anything about and where I didn't know anyone who'd been there besides my grandfather. So my grandfather was stationed there for most of the war because his unit was supposed to be defending Singapore and was on their way there when it became evident that they weren't needed there anymore. And so they wound up in the naval base that was operating in Sri Lanka at the time. It's the only part of the war that he's ever spoken about and that he ever shared with any of us, which I always found slightly strange until I really sat down and thought about it. He'd put his age up, so he was 19 years old at the time. He'd never been overseas beforehand and all of a sudden had found himself quite highly paid on a tropical island with not very much to do. When I thought of it that way, it suddenly became very understandable that these are his most treasured memories of the war. When I went there, it was a country that was still in war, and it was my first experience of living in conflict. And I learned a lot about what it is that we mean by peace. The war in Sri Lanka dates back to the year in which I was born. So I kept meeting people who'd known nothing other than a country in war and for whom peace was a really abstract concept. And it really took a lot of getting used to. And the last two lines in the poem, raw I am, unripe, I wrote very early on while I was staying there. They're part of the first word I learnt in Sinhalese. Raw and unripe are the same word when they use it for fruit. And I thought that was such a really interesting linguistic quirk, as it were. My pop also, when I went there, taught me the word lasanakela for pretty girl. I learnt that one pretty quickly as well. Colombo, day leave. Even the goited cat's hypnotic and unmoving in these hours. The sun crawl fractured on the lazy spin of copper pennies, coins falling thin and shiny, the small puffs of dust where they land in shrunken explosions. Years later, we buy him scratchies for his birthdays. Grandfather's always been a gambler. The pennies fell his way that day. His debts paid off, they waited every footstep. The city crowded round, the fat bats squawking over the dusty racecourse, the kasipu brewers, the hawkers spitting beetle, tubercular, in gutters. Years later, and he speaks like he can still taste the 15 dishes pulled from one mean chicken, see the thick braid of the hotel owner's daughter, sweep her shoulder, then the table as she lays the beer before him. Feel the thick beat of coins and red concrete on bare skin. When I started putting together the poems for Knuckled, I think I was actually in a very fortunate position because I'd been working at that stage as an editor for about 3 years. So I'd had a lot of experience reading manuscripts and poetry manuscripts in particular and seeing what worked and what didn't work. And I can clearly remember having a conversation with another editor at the time who was saying that the problem with a lot of first poetry books is that they are just a sampling of all of the work that the poet has written up until that point, whereas more established poets tend to have a structure and some sort of, not quite linearity, but a logical flow to the work, either an emotional logic or a geographical one or some sort of sense of movements within the book. So I very much took that to heart and had to be quite ruthless. There are a lot of poems that I had written in the past that I really loved but didn't feel supported the interior logic of the book. So I deliberately divided into thematic sections, one of which is all of the sort of suburban poems, another one that's kind of more of the emotional stuff, And then the third section, which is the longer sequence of Columbo poems to give the book sort of some sense of weight in the middle for what it were. And then the last two sections are a little looser, but kind of relate to each other in terms of place and water, as it turns out. So that became a kind of thematic thread. I ended up choosing a lot of the poems that were more recent than I expected. I did want to include a lot of older material, but I think when you're just learning your trade in particular, I'd realised that the way in which I wrote had changed so quickly and so often that putting together poems from vastly different time periods didn't often work. They were so different in tone and structure and often quality too, let's face it. Most of the poems in the book were written in the last 3 or 4 years, whereas I had 5, 6, 7 years worth of material to be going through. But I think in the end, the two main things that tie the collection together are a kind of interest in place and space and how we make meaning out of them or find shape within them, and language and the sort of social uses and what is revealed socially too through language and the way we speak to each other. Watching. My grandfather still talks about watching the city wells. The water sheen like oil slick on the loose, dark limbs of bathing women, of teaching boys to shoot at coconuts. He still talks of capturing a mascot monkey, its rapid syllabic scream like cartoon Japanese. He named it Hirohito and fed it from an army issue condom. My grandfather still talks of trading teenagers 3 cigarettes for fresh caught fish bleeding from the gills. How can I talk of the blue cotton dress cowed by a street girl's lengthening shoulders, playing cricket with an imagined bat and ball as the ladies of Colombo tested perfume? I ate white sandwiches and sushi at media launches for stray dog charities. Pause for thought, says businesswoman. I swore uselessly at the bandy-legged man who followed me home, his stumped tongue clicking. I bought Sprite and spirits by the bottle as white lights flashed and hashed machine smoke flooded over lycra girls and robot dancing men, nursed an absurd and felted head through the next day. How can I write of the sinuous coil of trishaws around a mid-street shrine, a concrete cobra's hood unfurled over the Buddha, the threat of that venomous umbrella precarious and beautiful? I know my grandfather shot at the cobras, susurrating into camp, only holding sacred his own fear. Old Jindabyne, flood. The waters rose, cold as a chaste kiss, and the cartography of our childhoods we left behind. Algae blooming where once our fingers printed, the wrecks of banisters and door handles. Old stories bloat and decay now, and the currents tug at church bells. Our cemetery ghosts grow gills. Barnacles and oysters cling like grieving widows to their gravestones. They say the clothesline's been tidal in our gardens of cabbage weed and grape weed, catfish, buried dog bones and buried pets. They say that soggy shadows of ourselves still walk on the old roads, stand in queues in banks, buy groceries in plastic bags, soft and bulbous as jellyfish. Now we skim stones, try to guess where they might land, and fish in tin boats, cast our lines toward the street lamps. I was fortunate enough to be awarded a residency in the Tasmanian Writers' Centre under the Island of Residencies program in 2007, which meant I had 3 or 4 weeks staying in Hobart in a beautiful old cottage, kind of perched halfway up a clifftop overlooking Salamanca Bay and Mount Wellington. And the back room of that house has been entirely lined with glass windows, so you have this almost panoramic view of Hobart, and it's impossible not to fall in love with the city staying there. It was the very first residency I'd ever had, the very first time anyone had actually given me something for my writing. In this case, it was a place to stay and space to write away from all of the kind of everyday stuff of life that can be so distracting. And I went there deliberately to work on the Columbo poems at the heart of the book. And it was just such a gift to be able to devote a dedicated chunk of time and a dedicated chunk of solid, uninterrupted thinking time to a sequence of poems. Such a treasured thing that is so special. It's such a wonderful thing as a writer to be actually told you are here to write, and all of the other stuff doesn't matter because that space is so rarely given over to you. It really made me feel like I was being taken seriously as a writer for the very first time. A few years after that, I also got an emerging writer's grant to work on the book, which is another one of those things that I don't think you can underestimate the importance of. Part of it is actually having the financial support, but there's a sense of trust and value that comes with that. So much of what you do as a writer is self-defined, that you say, I am a writer. You work for yourself and by yourself. So it's lovely to be given that sort of sense that somebody else believes in what you're doing, especially as someone without a publication record at that time and as someone who's still learning and continuing to learn, I suppose. Scarborough. We have buffeted our backs against the ocean. Bouldered and eroded, we spread our beach towels on the grass. This is salt. My chest is chambered. We have outstood it, the road. There's a gravity to hairpin bends. Behind, a frizzy couple upend shandies and share a crossword. Escarpment, the sharpness nestled in the very word. Our plate of squid tenses, the suckered tentacles hollowed. Cowweed yellows on the train line. This salt, desiccant and leaching. The bowl of ocean sweeps us, and we are good. We have outstood. This poem was a bit of a departure for me. I was trying a few different things out style-wise. I think the words and the shape of the words are much more important in this poem than in some of the others. It's deliberately quite a musical piece and a more personal piece than some of the other poems. I've been lucky enough to have the support of some very good workshop groups, the West Side Group, as I mentioned before, and a group of poets, all a fair bit older and more experienced than me, who I've learnt a lot from, who all live in the Inner West and tend to meet monthly. I've worked really hard with them on this sense of putting the personal into the poems and of getting a sense of a little bit more emotion and a little bit more connectedness, a little bit more of a human story within them. It's a very difficult thing to do, I found, to try and be more honest in your writing. It's a challenging thing and a really confronting thing sometimes. But once I got my head around it, I realised that that is what I like most when I read, this sort of sense of vulnerability or of kind of rawness to work. It's much more easy to relate to than something that's a bit more impersonal. This poem's really about a place on the south coast of New South Wales that I visit a fair bit with some friends. It's quite a peaceful and special place. And we always seem to end up going there when someone's feeling a little bit vulnerable. It's kind of a healing place as well. the last family holiday for Kim. Sitting big in a bar, curved and divisive as the equator, finalities hang like clammy fairy lights. Plastic bamboo on the walls, shirts budding and shameless as cocktail umbrellas, and no one mentions that the table is for three. Our father sips thickly from a coconut shell, his nose peeling like a pink prawn, his sweaty armpits and clumsy hands. The barman brings pink sugar and innuendo to the torn coaster of my sister. Our father's grin is a tortured thing. Our father still disbelieves the adultness of his daughters, coughs at the uncomfortable evidence of bad language, breasts and contraceptive pills, his damp hairline receding to a widow's peak. Tonight, he tongues around his cheeks, grappling for the shape of things to say. Slow static of electric ceiling fans. I've met this woman, girls.